Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Today's episode involves sexual assault, so I would like to emphasize listener discretion. The violent death of a loved one is difficult to accept. The agony of grief and anger reverberates through the rest of your life. Sometimes there is closure. You can learn to live with the grief. Justice can help with your anger. But what if your loved one's body was never found? How do you move past that? Especially when you know who did it, when you know who took that cherished life and cut out a piece of your heart. Your mind conjures the worst places their remains could be. It's the final cruelty of the murderer to hide the body and not give the family the peace of laying their loved one to rest. And historically, murder cases without a body are notoriously hard to try. By now, with all the advances we have in forensics, we can often prove a person is dead and prove who killed them without the body. But today's episode is a case from 1980. An 18-year-old college freshman from Virginia named Gina Renee Hall disappeared. Law enforcement had a suspect within days, but they could not find Gina's body. There were mountains of circumstantial evidence in Gina's case, including blood and hair evidence. But this was almost a decade before DNA testing had evolved enough to use in a murder trial. And yet the Commonwealth of Virginia successfully prosecuted her murderer, setting important legal precedent for the state of Virginia and the rest of the country. And almost 40 years later, the search for Gina Renee Hall continues. Welcome to episode 77, Virginia's first nobody conviction, the murder of Gina Renee Hall. It was a Saturday night, June 28th, 1980, and Gina Renee Hall was in the mood to go dancing. She had finished her grueling midterm exams at Radford University and planned to go to a nightclub near Virginia Tech. Gina lived with her older sister, Delana, who was in grad school at Radford, and she tried to talk her into joining her, but Delana, exhausted from her own exams, wanted to stay home that night. Gina had never gone out by herself before, but tonight she decided she would. She was determined to celebrate her hard work and dance the night away. She showered, curled her hair, and put on makeup. She put on a purple Danskin bodysuit and wore high-waisted white pants and a white jacket over it. She topped off the stylish look with velvet purple heels. As Gina was leaving, she stopped and realized she had forgotten her ankle bracelet. The gold bracelet of hearts intertwined was her favorite. She put it on and grabbed the car keys. It was a 1975 Chevy Monte Carlo. Their dad had bought the car for Delana, but the girls were sharing it as they lived together that summer. Delana walked her sister out, hugging her and telling her to be careful. At 1 a.m., the phone rang. Delana sleepily said hello, and the other caller said, "Delana?" Delana said, "Gina?" Gina said, "Yeah." Delana said, "Where are you?" Gina said, "I'm out at the lake." Delana said, "What are you doing at the lake?" And Gina said, "I'm looking at it." "Who are you looking at it with?" her sister asked. And Gina said, "Steve." "Please hurry home," Delana urged, and then the line went dead. Delana thought her sister sounded uneasy and nervous, and she thought it was out of character for Gina. But trusting that her sister was responsible and would be on her way home soon, Delana went back to sleep. When she woke again at 6:30 a.m., she immediately thought of the late-night call from Gina and went to check her room. She wasn't there, and the car wasn't in the parking lot. Delana knew something was very wrong. At 7:30 a.m., a young man Gina went to high school with showed up at the apartment. He was on leave from the Air Force, and this was a planned visit with his old friend. He and Gina were going to spend the day together. Instead, he spent the day with Delana, making phone calls and driving around looking for the car, Like Delana, he knew Gina Hall was not the type of girl to not come home and let her sister worry. Delana tried to call her dad but got no answer. By the afternoon, her boyfriend and several of their other friends had joined the search. Delana knew Gina had said she had been at the lake, and now she was terrified that Gina had run the car off the narrow two-lane mountain road between the lake and Radford. When it got dark, the group encouraged Delana to go ahead and call the Radford police. She did, but they told her Gina had to be missing 24 hours before a missing persons report could be filed. The dispatcher tried to reassure Delana that students usually turn up. But Delana knew her sister wasn't your average student, sleeping off a hangover somewhere. Her sister was missing. She called the Virginia State Police, who told her the same thing. She finally got a hold of their father at 9:30 p.m. John Hall and his wife were just walking in after a day of golfing and then dinner. He was immediately concerned. He knew Gina would never do something like this. He knew it in his gut. He wanted to drive to Radford right away, but it was 2.5 hours from Coburn, their hometown, so they agreed he would drive up in the morning. John Hall left before dawn the next day after getting no sleep. His wife, Joan, Gina's stepmother, stayed home with their two sons. The Halls were a deeply religious family, and John prayed fervently as he drove for God to bring Gina home safe and sound. Sadly, he would spend the rest of his life praying to find Gina. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Gina Renee Hall was born on August 24, 1961, in Coburn, Virginia. Coburn is nestled along the Guest River in Wise County, in the far western corner of Virginia, the kind of wholesome, tiny village where everyone knows your name. The population of Coburn has hovered around 2,000 since the 1960s when Gina was born. Gina was an active and popular girl growing up. She was particularly athletic, playing tennis, excelling at gymnastics, and she was the only girl on her high school's golf team. She was also a gifted dancer, and as a teen, she taught tap dancing and gymnastics to children. But there was a reason for her determined athleticism. When she was 2 years old, she brushed up against a burner on a gas stove, setting fire to the pajamas she was wearing. She suffered third-degree burns over 90% of the right side of her body at 2 years old. She was in the hospital for months, and doctors marveled at her recovery when 75% of children would have died from shock or sepsis from such grievous injuries. Through the mid-1960s into her teen years, Gina had over a dozen painful surgeries, skin grafts, and many wound excisions to remove the deep scarring. And the extreme scarring would leave the girl disfigured for life. From her shoulder to her elbow on her right arm, her chest and torso area, and her right leg from her upper thigh to her knee. One surgical incision had left an indention an inch deep around her right breast area. As you can imagine, Gina was very self-conscious about her scars. She always wore clothing that concealed her scars, even if that meant long sleeves in the hot Virginia summers. Even at the beach, she would cover up with towels and just wade into the surf. Her sister Delana told author Ron Peterson that her sister avoided any serious romantic relationships. She couldn't bear for anyone to see her scars. And as she grew older, the prospect of having children of her own was impossible. Her scarred skin would never stretch for a pregnancy. And it could be a serious risk to her life. So Gina avoided serious boyfriends even into college. She didn't believe she could lead a normal life of getting married and having babies. And she most certainly would never put herself in a situation that would risk that. Unfortunately, Gina's birth mother blamed herself for Gina's accident. Her extreme guilt caused mental health issues, and she left Gina and her sister Delana with their father to raise the girls alone. John Hall remarried when Gina was 6 years old to a lovely woman named Joan. Gina was really close to her stepmother, calling her Mama Joan. John and Joan provided a loving and stable home and two younger brothers for Gina to dote on. They were members of the Coburn United Methodist Church, where Gina taught Sunday school and led Bible study groups. John Hall owned a successful State Farm insurance agency in town, providing a comfortable, upper-middle-class living for his family. But Gina was a hard worker. Her parents encouraged her to take part-time jobs as a teenager, knowing the sort of work ethic and drive it could provide a young girl. Gina worked at the town's small movie theater and was a beloved employee and co-worker. In the fall of 1979, after Gina had graduated from Coburn High School, where she had been voted most popular, she chose to attend Emory and Henry College, a tiny 1,000-student school just an hour from Coburn. She had wanted to stay close to home and her family, and was probably nervous to attend a larger school after growing up in such a small town. Her sister Delana was already at Radford University and encouraged her younger sister to move to the larger school. So after one fall semester at Emory and Henry, Gina transferred to Radford University, which had a much better curriculum for Gina's chosen career. She wanted to be a nurse, and RU had a great nursing program. Radford University still wasn't a huge college. It had about 5,000 students. But it did have a bigger social scene, and Gina was finally coming out of her small-town shell a bit. RU is in the small town of Radford, Virginia, with around 13,000 residents when Gina was living there. But that is still a much bigger town than she would have been used to. Radford is a college town in every sense, and it lies along a horseshoe bend in the New River in southwest Virginia. Nearby towns of Blacksburg, Christiansburg, and small counties make up what is known as the New River Valley, sort of a larger close community made up of small towns and counties. Radford is where a boy named Stephen Madison Epperly was born in May of 1952 to parents Cubid and Esther. Cubid was a World War II vet who worked as a janitor in a powder plant. Esther was a stay-at-home mom, raising Stephen, known as Steve, and his brother and two sisters. They were a poor family who lived in a tiny home. But Cubid nurtured a love for the outdoors, hunting and fishing with his sons. Esther was deeply religious. The family belonged to the First Baptist Church of Radford, and attendance was non-negotiable in the Epperly household. Steve was mainly interested in sports in school. He played football, baseball, basketball, tennis, and ran track. But football was in his heart. He dreamed of a scholarship to Virginia Tech to play ball. But he didn't have the grades. He was mainly a C student who was known more for his temper. While still in elementary school, teachers took more of a boys-will-be-boys attitude with Steve's hyper nature, calling him a high-energy boy. By the time he was in high school, playing football with the Radford High Bobcats, Steve had a hair-trigger temper and was known as a school bully. He wasn't much different at home. When Steve was 18 and his sister was 15, they got into an argument and Steve hit her. Esther tried to get in the middle, and Steve got violent with his own mother as well. Esther Epperly called the police, and Stephen was arrested for domestic assault. He was booked at the Radford police station until Esther, maybe embarrassed or worried about Stephen's record, asked that the charges be dropped. When Stephen graduated in 1971, his dreams of being recruited were dimmed. Though he stood 5'11" tall, he only weighed 175 pounds, too small to play football at a high collegiate level. His high school coach advised Steve to start out at a junior college while he bulked up, and then he could transfer to one of the big-time football schools when he was ready. So Stephen Epperly enrolled in Ferrum Junior College, about an hour and 15 minutes away from home. It's now a four-year college with Division III athletics, but then it was a springboard for students like Steve. In the summer before college, friends noticed a marked change in Steve. Always hot-tempered, he was becoming more violent, picking fights and going into a rage. It often took three or four guys to pull Steve off of someone he was pummeling. And this aggression was not reserved for men. Steve developed a reputation of forcing himself on girls he dated. Quickly, his friends refused to double date with Steve after hearing what he had done to a girl. And this was the early 70s. Date rape and sexual assault in general were not taken seriously. At this time, none of the girls pressed charges, but Steve had now gained an even worse reputation. His parents had to make quite a financial sacrifice to send Steve to Ferrum. It's not as if he had earned a scholarship. And at Ferrum, he did bulk up. He did not, however, distinguish himself on the playing field or in the classroom. He was still a mediocre student, half-assing his way through school, more interested in partying and getting into fights. In his first summer back in Radford, Steve's reputation grew even worse. He was bigger now and enjoyed his intimidating bulk. His second year at Ferrum didn't go any better. There were no recruiters coming to see him play, and Steve's dreams of playing big ball in college were dashed. He came home for Christmas in 1972 and did not return to Ferrum. His failure caused him to be even more bitter, as many of his former teammates were already playing major college football. He took a couple of classes at Radford University, keeping a part-time job to help pay for it since he had exhausted his parents' finances at Ferrum. Radford had only gone co-ed the year before in 1971, and now the female student population soared. Steve became a fixture at popular nightclubs and bars, always on the hunt for girls. And he was still picking fights. If someone bumped into him with a drink and he didn't think their apology was good enough, he would just start punching. A vicious fighter, Steve didn't just bust a lip or blacken an eye. He would break your jaw. And he was even more aggressive with women. In fact, that was usually his objective in going out every night, to find a girl. Steve did eventually try out for the Virginia Tech football team as a walk-on in the spring of 1975. But again, his off-the-field antics were more dominant than any natural talent on the field. And by the fall of 75, his college football eligibility was over. He kept taking classes at Virginia Tech while also working part-time and living at home with his parents. And he started working as a bouncer in nightclubs, seemingly a natural fit for someone who enjoyed using his fists. On April 22, 1976, a woman woke around 3:15 a.m. to someone outside her bedroom window. Looking out, she saw Steve Epperly, whom she had dated very briefly a few months before. He said, "Let me in, I'm in trouble." So she did, and Steve immediately pushed her to the floor and raped her. When she tried to scream, Steve put his hands around her throat. The young woman had an infant son asleep in a nearby room who started crying when he heard his mother scream. Steve let her get up to go check on her son, and when she did, she grabbed the baby and ran out the door. She called the police and reported the rape. Stephen Epperly was arrested and charged with rape at the Montgomery County Jail. His parents bailed him out and sacrificed yet again to get Steve the best lawyer possible. Steve's side of the story was that it was a consensual encounter, as he and the woman had previously dated. He waived his right to a jury trial and went before a judge, who deemed the sexual assault a he said, she said case and dismissed the charges. Despite his reputation, Steve had gotten away with it. And 4 months later, he did it again. In August of 1976, he was at a pool near the Virginia Tech campus and met a 19-year-old student. He invited her to a party he said he and his roommates were having a few blocks away. She tried to politely decline, but Steve kept pestering her and seemed friendly enough, so she finally followed him. It's unclear if Steve actually had his own apartment with roommates or if he was taking this girl to a friend's apartment. From everything I read, he almost always lived with his parents, though he did occasionally couch surf with friends in other towns. Either way, he led her into an apartment and immediately threw her down, violently raping her. He strangled her to the point that she lost consciousness. When he was finished, he strangely became emotional, crying about his parents and how he had let them down. He even said the words to her, quote, "Oh my God, do you know I've raped you?" She later said he even said he would go turn himself in, and she told him not to, that she wouldn't go to the police. She just wanted to get out of there. She did report him, and Stephen Epperly was arrested again for sexual assault. Only this time, he opted for a jury trial. Once again, his poor parents had to scrape up the money for a defense attorney. And once again, Steve would come out with a clean record. As was common in the 70s, the victim was more on trial. She was grilled about her sexual history, how much she had to drink, and what she was wearing that night. The jury voted not guilty, and Stephen Epperly went on with his life. He continued taking classes at Virginia Tech, graduating after 7 years in 1978 with a bachelor's degree in business administration. Despite their son's terrible behavior and series of arrests, Cupid and Esther Epperly were very proud of their son. He was the first college graduate in the family. But the real Stephen Epperly was a bully and a sexual predator, and everyone knew it. People were scared of him in Radford, and with good reason. Though he had a degree, he had no job offers. He worked in Richmond for a while, but couldn't make ends meet, so he wound up back at his parents' house. Back in Radford, he was known as the town bully. He had trouble holding down jobs, going from one to another, even getting his real estate license at one point, though he never sold one property. In the summer of 1980, Stephen Epperly, with a degree in business administration, took a job on the grounds crew of Radford University. The pay was shitty, and he still lived with his parents, as friends joked behind his back that he was the best educated landscaper in town. But he still liked to party in Blacksburg, where Virginia Tech was located. And on the night of June 28th, he went to the Marriott Inn Lounge, a popular nightclub for dancing. It was the same nightclub where Gina Hall had decided to go dancing that night. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from our sponsors. With the holidays just around the corner, there's one gift that thousands of moms are calling the best gift ever. I always want to get my mom something special. I almost always give her framed photographs, but with the Skylight Frame, I'm giving her all of my favorite photos from the last year. Skylight Frame is a touchscreen photo frame you can update instantly by email from anywhere. Everyone in the family can just email photos to the frame and they will appear in seconds. Skylight Frame has a gorgeous 10-inch touchscreen, and you can swipe through the photos with your finger. It's a black frame with a white mat, so it looks as stylish as any real photo frame and is a beautiful addition to your home. It only takes about 60 seconds to set up and connect to your wireless network, so it's basically plug and play. And Skylight Frames come with 100% satisfaction guaranteed. If you don't love your Skylight, they will offer you a full refund. I can't wait to see my mom's face when she plugs this in and sees all the preloaded photos from me, my sister, and other family members. She's going to be delighted. As a special holiday offer, you can get $10 off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com and enter the promo code CRIME. That's right. To get $10 off your purchase of a Skylight Frame, just go to skylightframe.com and enter the promo code CRIME. That's SKYLIGHTFRAME.com, promo code CRIME. As Gina Hall made her way to Blacksburg on her own to go dancing, Stephen Epperly was going out with a group of guys. One of those was a friend named Bill King, whose mother and stepfather owned a cabin on Clater Lake. They were out of town, and Bill had promised to check in on the cabin. He also had permission to use the cabin as long as he cleaned up afterwards. Bill was going out with Steve and three other guys they had gone to school with. He picked up Steve, and they went to make sure the cabin was secure before joining the other three guys in Blacksburg at the Marriott Inn Lounge around 11 p.m. Gina pulled into the parking lot around the same time the group of guys did, but witnesses did not see her come in with the group of guys or talking to them. Instead, she spotted a group of friends at a table and sat down with them. Bill King would later testify that the tiny, attractive Gina Hall caught Steve's eye as she walked past. She was only 5 feet tall, weighing a little over 100 pounds. Her dark hair was styled into bouncy curls, as was the fashion, and she was striking in her purple and white outfit. Gina made eye contact with Steve and was happy when he asked her to dance, as she was dying to get on the dance floor. They danced to about 4 or 5 songs, and after about 30 minutes, left the dance floor, and Gina walked back to the table with her friends instead of going to sit down with Steve. According to his friends, Steve would only be dancing with a girl if he wanted to have sex with her. Unlike Gina, who was dancing because she loved to, Steve had other designs and was unhappy when she didn't join him at his table. But he remained polite, approaching Gina a couple more times. Bill King later said it was implicit that Steve would be using his cabin for a one-night stand, even before they got to the nightclub. He felt sorry for his loser friend that still lived with his parents and didn't mind if Steve brought a girl back to the cabin. He planned on bringing a date back there too. And this is where things get murky. Bill King, Epperly, and other witnesses said that Gina went willingly and even drove to the cabin, as Steve didn't have his car there. But Gina's sister has long insisted that she would never have left the club willingly with Steve Epperly. She thought it was possible that she had been tricked, as in thinking she was joining a group, but otherwise, she thought Gina would have been forced. Remember, Gina was not sexually active. She didn't date. Her severe scarring from the burns had essentially caused her to cut her off from dating and men in general. Some witnesses thought Gina had agreed to go with a group for a midnight swim at the lake, but that doesn't make any sense either. We know Gina would not have disrobed in front of anyone, much less a bunch of guys she had just met. In 2013, on an internet comment board, a new witness to that evening spoke up and eventually got in touch with Delana, Gina's sister. Kimberly Jett claimed that she tried several times to talk to someone about meeting Gina that fateful night. Considering the extensive investigation to come, I find it strange that she could not manage an interview with police once Gina went missing. It was front page news and nightly TV news all over Virginia. But she says that she talked to Gina for about 20 minutes in the club, and Gina asked if she could sit down with her and her friend, because Stephen Epperly was bothering her. Kimberly said she knew Stephen and his reputation, and she welcomed Gina to her table. She even claims that Steve approached their table, and she and her friends chased him off. Not long after this, Kimberly and her friends were ready to go. She said she asked Gina to walk out with them, but Gina wasn't ready and said she would be fine. She later insisted that Gina never would have left willingly with Steve Epperly. He had already been harassing her. Delana has naturally grasped onto this. For years, she insisted her sister would not have gone willingly, and I still think that could be true. We will get to why I and others believe that later. I don't know about this Kimberly, though. I don't see how it took her 33 years to tell this story. But Delana believes her, writing about it in her own book, and it has been widely reported, so I thought I should mention it. Certainly, her portrayal of Stephen Epperly tracks. Once he danced with Gina, he had marked her as his territory and was not going to let it go. That makes a lot of sense. But I think anyone could tell this story now, and it makes sense considering what happened that night. However it happened, Steve and Gina left the club with Steve driving her car. And then Delana got that strange call from her sister at 1 a.m. We have what Delana said Gina said, and I take her word for Gina's uneasy tone. It seems to me that Gina was maybe stalling Steve, telling him that she needed to call and check in with her sister. So Gina did call Delaina and told her she was at the lake with a man named Steve. Maybe she thought if Steve heard this, he wouldn't hurt her. We don't know, and we can't know exactly what happened next, but the blood evidence would later show a vicious attack. Bill King and his friends had stayed longer at the nightclub before going to a house party in Pulaski County. Bill bumped into an old girlfriend and asked her if she would like to go for a late-night swim at the cabin. She agreed, and they got to the cabin around 3:45 a.m. They saw Gina's brown Monte Carlo in the driveway, and Bill parked beside it. As Bill went inside with his date, they both heard Steve say, "Bill, is that you?" Bill said, "Yeah," and then he said he and his date were going down to the dock to go swimming. They said that Steve said he had to leave. Bill told him he didn't have to, that he could stay at the house. But Steve said, quote, "Well, she's got to be getting back." It's important to note that neither Bill nor his date ever saw Gina Hall. After the couple went down to swim, they said Steve flicked on the back porch light to get their attention and said, "Bill, we're leaving." They later testified it was around 4:15 to 4:30 a.m. They saw Steve briefly in the light, but not Gina. After he left, Bill and his date went to the den and laid down on the carpet in the den, and Bill felt a wet spot with his foot. He thought at the time that Steve and Gina must have lain there in wet bathing suits. Stephen Epperly would later insist that Gina drove him back to his house and dropped him off, and then she went home. And he never saw her again after that. By the next morning, Delaina had already raised the alarm that Gina was missing. And though the local and state police couldn't do anything yet, a patrol officer from Pulaski County had passed Gina's car twice. He was on a routine patrol in southern Pulaski County, driving along Hazel Hollow Road. Hazel Hollow runs beside New River and happens to be the only road to take between the house on Clater Lake and the town of Radford. There is a historic train trestle that crosses over Hazel Hollow, and as the deputy passed below the trestle, he noticed a brown car parked near the riverbank with the trunk open. The deputy did not stop and later defended himself by saying it was a popular area for fishermen to park and access the river. Unfortunately, a car burglar with quite the record spotted Gina's car and rifled through it. Gina had left her purse under the driver's seat, and Delaina's was there too. He grabbed both purses and ran. He later said it took him 60 seconds to do the snatch and grab on the open car. At around midnight, the same deputy had just started his shift again and saw the car again. This time, he stopped behind the car and looked around, but he didn't see anything suspicious. He did call it in and reported that the car was registered in Coburn, Virginia. The deputy asked the dispatcher to run the plate and see if it was stolen, and the dispatcher said no. So the deputy left the car again. The morning after the nightclub, before it was widely known that Gina was missing, Bill King and his date woke up at the lake house. They cleaned up after themselves and left. Bill King went and picked up his 4-year-old son from his grandmother's house and then headed back to the cabin. He had invited a few friends over for a cookout that afternoon, including Steve Epperly. He once again stepped on the wet spot on the den carpet, but still didn't think much of it. As everyone else was outside for the cookout, Steve said he was going inside for a soda. Bill King would later testify that he thought it took Steve a while. He was in the cabin much longer than it would take to get a soda. Investigators would come to believe that Steve was doing a more thorough cleanup than he had the night before, and he didn't even come back with a soda. In the meantime, the search for Gina Hall was ramping up. By the next morning, John Hall was at Delaina and Gina's apartment, asking questions and made new calls to the police. Now it had been 30 hours, and both the Radford police and the Virginia State Police told them to come in and file formal reports. Radford PD put out a BOLO, be on the lookout, to all the surrounding jurisdictions. Unfortunately, the Pulaski patrol officer who had spotted Gina's car was off duty when the BOLO went around and he didn't see it. While this was going on, friends and family and volunteers were looking everywhere. Mr. Hall tasked two guy friends to find Gina's car, and they did, before the police knew about it, despite the deputy having called it in. Somehow, Pulaski County had not connected the deserted car and the missing girl. Radford investigators headed to the car immediately, and the sergeant in charge looked in the trunk and saw blood. He cordoned off a crime scene, careful to make sure other officers were not walking around the car disturbing any footprints or other evidence. A Virginia State Police trooper, Austin Hall, was nearby and called to the scene. Though he did not have experience in murder investigations, he was assigned to take the lead. This normally would not have been protocol, but oddly enough, for a small town, Radford had another homicide that happened right around the same time, and investigators were still tied up with that scene. But Trooper Austin Hall would prove to be an incredible asset to the case, and later, a valuable witness at trial. He was no relation to Gina Hall's family. Trooper Hall called in a major crime scene unit. They took samples of the blood and what looked to be pubic hair, as well as fingerprints from the car. Every officer involved now believed that Gina Hall had met with foul play. This was no longer a missing persons case. This was a homicide investigation, and the first thing they needed to do was find the body. Trooper Hall called in local rescue squads to search the river for Gina's body or any other evidence. The Blacksburg Rescue Squad sent in an extremely experienced diver who would search the river numerous times with no luck. Trooper Hall went and questioned Delana and her friends, and he asked for a hair sample of Gina's. Delana handed him her sister's hair curlers in tears. By now, the trooper had sat down with John Hall and told him he needed to pray for the best, but prepare for the worst. Though Trooper Hall had not yet said it was foul play, John Hall and Delana already knew if they were looking for hair samples, this was bad. By the next morning, July 1st, Bill King finally heard a news report about Gina Renee Hall and recognized her name as the girl that Steve had been with that night. He went straight to a gym that Steve usually worked out at, but he wasn't there. He shared the news with their mutual friends, who were all a bit shocked. Steve's reputation at this point was as a hothead and bully, but in Radford, few people knew that he had been charged twice with rape. That's because it happened in Blacksburg, and he was acquitted. Bill finally found Steve working on campus that day. When he told Steve what was going on, he said if it was him, he would go ahead and call the police as soon as possible so they wouldn't think he had anything to hide. He later testified that Steve said, "Who all knows I was with her?" Bill was kind of confused at first and told him everyone at the gym was talking about it, and Steve asked him to go back and, quote, tell them not to say anything, just kind of talk it down, not broadcast it. And then Steve went back to work. And his friend, Bill King, knew that he had to contact the police and tell them everything he knew. But Steve Epperly did take his friend's advice, and he called the police himself at 3 p.m. that day and agreed to meet with Trooper Hall at 5:30 p.m. He later said Epperly was clean-cut, with a firm handshake and good eye contact. Not what you would expect in a murder suspect. Epperly seemed forthcoming, telling about dancing with Gina at the club and then going back to the cabin. He even said that he and Gina had kissed, but that she told him she once had a bad experience with a man and didn't know him well enough to go any further. Steve claimed he was fine with that, and they got in her car and she drove him home. And that was the last time he saw her. Steve also readily agreed to take a polygraph exam. While Trooper Austin Hall did find Steve Epperly convincing, he was the last person to see Gina Hall alive. That person is routinely the main suspect. Hall got a detective to run a background report on Epperly, but there was nothing but traffic tickets and a reckless driving citation. Remember, there was no conviction in his rape cases, so there were no hits on his record. But Stephen Epperly still seemed fishy. They scheduled a follow-up interview and the polygraph as soon as possible. In the meantime, Steve went to see a buddy of his, a local businessman named Tom Hardy, who, while technically was on the up and up, he had a long rap sheet, mainly to do with drugs, alcohol, and traffic incidents. It seemed like a strange friendship. Stephen Epperly infamously did not do drugs and barely drank alcohol. He was a health nut long before it was fashionable. This was before shining gyms with perky trainers were on every corner. Steve worked out in a dim backroom gym with other jocks. He liked to stay big and bulky. Author Ron Peterson wrote that word on the street was Steve was actually Tom Hardy's muscle man in his drug dealing business. Hardy did own several legitimate businesses, but he ran with a rough crowd and was an alcoholic and drug user himself. However, he did have another friend with even more connections. And when Steve came to him, they took a ride out to see a man named Bill Cranwell, ironically, another Virginia Tech grad and star football player. But he also had a reputation as a fixer. Steve also went to see his friend Tom to connect with Bill Cranwell for another reason. He did not have the money to hire an attorney. His parents were flat broke from his two previous rape cases, and Bill's brother was a powerful attorney in Roanoke. Steve asked Bill if he thought his brother would represent him. But Bill Cranwell told him no right off. His brother was not just a good lawyer. He was a politician in the Virginia House of Representatives, and he knew he would not take Steve's case. No politician in their right mind would want to represent a man accused of murdering a young woman. Then Steve said something that made Bill Cranwell's blood run cold. He said, quote, "When you talk to your brother, ask him if there's anything they can do to me if they don't find the body." After Steve and Tim left, Cranwell went and looked at the newspaper to read about the missing girl and was shocked when he saw Gina's name. John Hall had been Bill Cranwell's roommate in college. He picked up the phone and called the police right away. Despite his own dubious connections with Hardy and others, he was very loyal to his friend and old hokey roommate, John Hall. So Steve Epperly's follow-up interview went a bit different than he probably expected. The captain of the Radford Police Department showed up on campus to Steve's job, asking for an informal chat. This time, Steve added a detail. He said Bill and his date had seen him and Gina leave that night. The captain asked Steve again if he would take a polygraph, and Steve said he would come to the station right after work. By now, officers had done more digging around in Steve Epperly's past. His reputation as the town bully was talked about, and then someone remembered a story about Epperly raping a woman on a first date and then holding her hand over a gas burner, telling her he would kill her if she told the police. Again, this was the late 70s and early 80s. It's disgusting to think like this now, but it wasn't that unusual for a man to have a reputation of being overly aggressive with women, and people would choose to look the other way. But that story got the investigators to digging, and they immediately discovered Epperly's two prior rape trials. They got both police reports from Blacksburg and immediately made several connections. The attacks were very similar, and both times, Steve had tricked the victim into being alone with him. Everyone who knew Gina felt she had to have been tricked or coerced to leave the club with Stephen Epperly. The police were disheartened by the outcome of those cases. These were clearly violent rapes, and those women did not get justice. And they now knew for sure, not just by rumor, that Stephen Epperly was a sexual predator. They also knew they had to prioritize their interview with his friend, Bill King. Bill agreed to meet them at the cabin and give them permission to search while he was questioned. He flat out denied seeing Gina Hall leave with Steve that night or even seeing her at all at the cabin. He knew they were together at the club and had left together, but that was it. He had never actually laid eyes on the girl once back at the cabin. He only saw her car. He was not going to lie for his friend, and neither did his date. As investigators searched the house, they found a large oval stain on the den carpeting, in the same spot that Bill had felt was wet. Someone had tried to clean the light-colored shag carpet, but it was now a large pink spot. On hands and knees, investigators combed the house, finding more bloodstains in four separate rooms of the house. They swabbed each stain with a Q-tip to preserve the blood. After all the blood from the house and Gina's car was processed, it was found to be type O, which was Gina's blood type, but it was also that of about 40% of the population. And yes, this was before DNA, but blood typing was used in criminal trials. And besides, this was now proof that something terrible and violent had happened in that cabin. One investigator spotted something shiny on the spiral staircase. It was a gold bracelet or ankle bracelet with interlocking hearts. The clasp was broken. But it was exactly the piece of jewelry Delana had described her sister wearing that night. As the search of the house continued, Trooper Austin Hall knew it was time to talk to the Commonwealth Attorney, Everett Shockley. Shockley immediately went to look at the cabin himself. There were even two bloodstains outside of the house, one near the garage door and one on the wooden deck at the back of the house. This stain was right outside of the sliding glass doors of the second floor. They had found bloodstains in a bathroom on the second floor, on the light switch and faucet handle. Shockley also got to see the huge stain in the den for himself. Right next to the den, about 10 feet away, was a utility room where drops of blood were found on a chair, a pair of shoes, a dustpan, a mattock, which is like a digging tool for the garden. And there was a golf shoe with blood and what appeared to be pubic hair embedded in the spikes near the toe of the shoe. The implications of that are chilling. An investigator explained the small blood drops as, quote, the result of forceful blows. I think he would mean cast off from the weapon. There was also a large smear found on the refrigerator door with carpet fibers embedded in it. It would look like when Steve was cleaning up the blood, he did go for a soda. Perhaps that is what he was doing when he was in the house so long that afternoon, scrubbing the carpet some more. By now, Stephen Epperly had taken his polygraph examination back at the station and had failed. He showed deception on the questions, did you harm Gina Hall? Did you kill Gina Hall? And do you know the current whereabouts of Gina Hall? He was already the prime suspect. The polygraph just sealed the deal. But he again agreed to come in voluntarily for another interview. Only this one would be an interrogation. They read him his Miranda rights first. Epperly still agreed to answer questions without an attorney. He told the exact same story he had been telling all along, but this time Trooper Hall showed him photos of the evidence collected and bluntly said, Steve, we know that you killed her. At first, Steve yelled, I did not, I told you what happened. And then Hall used the, it could have been an accident, just tell me what happened tactic. Epperly went silent, crossing his arms. Then he tried to guilt him about Gina's family needing to give her a proper burial. Epperly remained silent. Then he hinted that if Steve cooperated and showed them to Gina's body, the Commonwealth and a jury would look more favorably on him. At this, Steve kept insisting he didn't know where she was. The cops kept begging him to talk, and he replied, I'll think about it. And got up and walked out. He still wasn't under arrest yet. A search of Epperly's house did not bring about any new evidence. Now Bill King's mother and stepfather were back from their vacation. They were naturally horrified to discover what had happened in their home, and they were able to go through the cabin and tell police six things that were missing. A quilt from a quilt rack by their bed. A bath mat from the bathroom where blood was found. A can of Dow bathroom cleaner from the same bathroom, a roll of paper towels from the utility room, and two towels, one blue and one an older blue striped towel. And the search for Gina Hall had only intensified. The reward for finding her body was up to $5,000. That would be more than $16,000 today. And that kind of reward brought out all kinds of volunteers, small boat owners, teenagers hiking around the lake. Anyone and everyone seemed to be searching for Gina Hall. Psychics were already contacting the Hall family, and as grieving families will, they allowed them to try. One very infamous psychic said that Gina was not in the river, nor was she in Clater Lake. He said she was buried near water, but that's still very vague. One thing I haven't talked about is Clater Lake. It was searched, but it is a large lake, 21 miles or 34 kilometers long, on over 4,000 acres. The maximum depth is about 115 feet. It was searched and dragged like the river, but Gina wasn't found. Later that day, Gina's old boss from the movie theater was out looking around in his boat. I told you, lots of people were looking because of the reward. But many, many more were looking out of love for Gina and her devastated family. Her old boss was trolling the banks of the New River when he spotted something blue. He gingerly grabbed it with a stick and saw blood stains. He immediately handed it over to the police, and Bill King's mother identified it as one of the missing towels. A captain with the Radford police who liked to fish on his days off went out on Tuesday, July 8th. But he could not bring himself to fish when Gina Hall was still missing, so he started searching. He found one of her purple heels on the Radford side of the New River, near the end of the railroad bridge, buried in some brush. By July 10th, Gina had been missing 12 days. Commonwealth attorney Shockley readily agreed when a state police sergeant recommended a tracker dog trainer he knew from Pennsylvania. John Preston, a retired Pennsylvania state trooper, who was qualified as a dog tracking expert in 17 states. Along with his German Shepherd, he had worked more than 150 criminal cases across the United States. Preston and his dog, named Harass 2, arrived the next day. The police had already gone to the Epperly home with a search warrant for something personal of Steve's, but his mother Esther just said okay and handed over a pair of Steve's dirty underwear. Neither Preston nor the dog had ever been to the Radford area before. Then Preston and investigators returned to where Gina's car had been left and let the dog acquire the scent from the clothing. The dog picked up the scent about 100 yards from where Gina's car had been found. He left the road and headed up a grade toward the railroad trestle and started walking along the tracks. The dog led his handler on a roundabout tour of Radford, touching each location where searchers had found some of Gina's clothing. From the railroad tracks, the dog followed the trail through town, finally entering a subdivision and walked up to the front door of a house and sat down. The dog had stopped on the front porch of Stephen Epperly's home. The next day, the dog was again given Epperly's scent and introduced to six blue towels, including the one that had been found near Gina's car. The dog immediately sat down in front of the blue towel found by searchers in the woods. That towel was not only stained with Gina's blood type, but also carpet fibers consistent with those found in the cabin. Stephen Epperly was being interviewed by Radford police at the station the next day when Preston and the dog showed up. While the suspect was inside, the dog was scented on the blue towel. The dog poked around the parking lot, which contains several other cars, and stopped at the driver's side door of Epperly's car. The dog then picked up the trail from the car to the police station and came directly to the door of the interrogation room where Stephen was sitting. The investigators then told Stephen Epperly what the dog had just done. He looked shocked and put his head down in his arms. When he raised his head, he said, quote, "That's a damn good dog." He said it three times. And yet, surprisingly, they still did not arrest and charge Stephen Epperly after this. He hung around town, hearing people whisper and seeing them point at him. He was fired from his job as groundskeeper at Radford University once the president of the university found out he was the main suspect in a student's murder. With nowhere else to turn to, Stephen contacted one of the attorneys who had gotten him out of the second rape charge. The first thing he said was, "Shut up. Quit talking to the police." The second thing he said was that if Epperly was charged with murder, his fee would start at $50,000 and would grow with billing hours and other charges. But he told Stephen Epperly that if the police did not have a body or an eyewitness, there was no way they could convict him. Stephen Epperly would bet his life on this. I'm going to pause now to hear a final word from one of today's sponsors. As a podcaster, I'm tied to social media 24/7, and I also travel a lot, so I am always on my phone. That's why I've always had to use bulky impact cases, and they're not cute. Since I'm so tied to my phone, I would like the case to be stylish. That's why I was so excited to get my new phone case from Casetify. Casetify doesn't make you sacrifice style to keep your phone safe. With military-grade drop protection and super cute designs, you get the best of both worlds. Casetify cases are as sleek as they are stylish, and they have thousands of designs to choose from. And Casetify collaborates with many name brands and artists. They have collections with Wonder Woman, Pokemon, and the Rolling Stones. You can also create your own custom cases with your favorite colors and text. And a Casetify case really does protect your phone. They have passed impact tests from drops of more than 6 feet. With that security and style, you can show off your new phone case on Insta and feel like a celebrity influencer. Try it today. Go to Casetify.com/Southern Fried to get 20% off your new phone case. That's Casetify.com/Southern Fried for 20% off your Casetify purchase. I do most of my holiday shopping online, which is super convenient, but it can also be easy to overspend. To me, that's worse than actually going to the store and standing in line. Luckily, I use Honey. It's a free browser extension that saves you time and money with online shopping. Honey scans the internet for coupon codes and other discounts, and then magically, Honey automatically applies the best deal to your online cart at checkout. Honey scans over 20,000 sites like Target, Macy's, Domino's, and my favorite, Amazon. I just shop like I normally would, and then see that lovely discount applied before I check out. It's amazing. It's like finding a 20 in your coat pocket. I've already been stockpiling Christmas gifts I ordered on Amazon. On one big order, I saved $72.75 with the Honey extension. To date, Honey has found over $1 billion in savings from their 10 million users like me. Listen, there's really no reason not to use Honey. It's free to use and installs on your computer in just 2 clicks. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/SFTC. That's joinhoney.com/SFTC. On July 19th, yet more evidence was found, this time by teenagers interested in the case. As they moved along the brush, one in the group spotted the blue striped towel, and it also had blood stains. A few minutes later, another one in the group found what looked to be a bunch of clothes. Then they found a mattock, the digging tool. Trooper Austin Hall was searching in a different area and was immediately called over. The towel would be identified by Bill's parents. But now, Gina's clothes had been found. It was her purple bodysuit, white pants, and white jacket. The white clothing was so covered in blood that parts of it looked maroon. A sobbing Delana positively identified the clothing as Gina's. She told author Ron Peterson, quote, "We already knew that Gina was dead, but when I looked at her outfit that day at the police station, that's when it finally hit me that Gina was really gone." The next day, a shovel was also found. Esther Epperly identified the shovel and the mattock as belonging to the Epperlys. By July 25th, the reward for finding Gina's body had reached $10,000, more than $32,000 today. In mid-August, Everett Shockley, the Commonwealth attorney, called Stephen Epperly's last attorney of record, though he had not been yet paid a retainer or taken this case officially. He did speak for his former client. Shockley straight out told him that their primary concern was recovering Gina's body. He was willing to offer Stephen Epperly second-degree murder if he would lead them to her body. He would only be sentenced to 20 years. The attorney who had told Stephen Epperly that they could never convict him without a body said, quote, "My client declines the offer." It may sound like hubris, but the state of Virginia had never convicted a murderer without a body. It dates back to English common law from the 1600s. 3 men were convicted and hung for murder of a man who came walking back into the village almost 3 years later. saying he'd been kidnapped and enslaved. After that, English law declared no body, no murder. That stuck until around the 1900s. There was a 1954 case in England that finally changed the law there, but it wasn't until the 1959 case of People versus Scott in the U.S. that legal no body precedence was formed. Basically, a man had killed his wife for her insurance. He claimed she simply left. Her friends and family strongly disagreed. He was eventually convicted after part of her eyeglasses and dentures were found under his house. In 2019, that would be strong evidence. Not so much in 1954, but her eye doctor and dentist testified identifying the pieces, and the man was convicted. It was unheard of then, but it was upheld on appeal, a first in the U.S. I tried to find exactly how many no-body murder convictions had happened in the U.S. before 1980 and in which state, but it's tricky. It's not that no one was ever convicted, but they usually had confessed or there was an eyewitness. Investigators for the state of Virginia found four cases without eyewitnesses or confessions. Epperly's defense attorneys would only find two other cases all over the world since the 1660 English law had passed. To try a no-body case without a confession or eyewitness, especially in the days before DNA, was incredibly risky. Everett Shockley knew that. He knew that if he took Stephen Epperly to trial and lost, if Gina's body was never found, double jeopardy would apply and there would be nothing he could do. This speaks to the massive search effort underway for Gina's body and how much the state was willing to pay. Estimates at that point were that the state had spent around $500,000 investigating and trying to locate Gina's body. That's over $1.6 million today. A recent study by an Iowa State University sociology professor estimates that the average murder trial costs the public over $17 million today. Obviously, the costs have risen along with advances in forensics and technology. It also explains the high number of plea bargains. Prosecutors are often criticized for offering plea bargains, but among the many other obstacles they face, they must also weigh the evidence and possible outcome against a state budget. That sucks, but it's the reality. And let's not forget, Shockley did offer a deal in exchange for Gina's body, but Epperly turned him down. No one believes that Everett Shockley took Epperly to trial without Gina's body to make a name for himself. He, along with family, friends, and strangers all over the New River Valley area, wanted justice for Gina Hall. When she was 2 years old and barely survived the horrific injuries from her pajamas catching fire, her community had rallied around her. Her sister Delana said she became Coburn's girl. It wasn't just that she was kind, pretty, and popular. Her hometown felt a possessive affection for their girl, and that affection extended to sympathy for her family and surrounding communities in Virginia when she went missing. Stephen Epperly was receiving death threats by mail and by phone. He even moved to Roanoke with a friend for a while to get out of town because he was so scared. And by now, it was a national news story. This case was not going away. And Shockley was more worried about waiting because of the potential of losing crucial witnesses. Memories fade. People die. Anything could happen if he waited. Not to mention the fact that he and all of Virginia law enforcement now knew they had a sexual predator in their midst. What if Stephen raped again? What if he murdered another girl? Not prosecuting him would set a dangerous social precedent, not just legal. It shows murderers that if you hide the body well enough, you can get away with it. So Shockley convened a grand jury. He chose Trooper Austin Hall as the one witness to present evidence. After his testimony, the grand jury had many questions, but in the end, they voted unanimously to indict Stephen Epperly. Stephen Epperly was finally arrested and formally charged on September 9th. It sounds as though it took a long time, but that is really only 2.5 months after Gina disappeared. That also speaks to the pressures of getting this case to trial. The public demanded it. In a pretrial hearing, Epperly had to appear before the judge and declare himself indigent. He could not afford an attorney. The judge in the case had anticipated this and had already tapped two young lawyers to represent Epperly, who were in court that day. The trial was held in Pulaski County, where Gina's car was found and where the cabin with all the blood evidence was. Woody Lookabill and David Warburton were in their late 20s with a brand new practice. A trial of this magnitude could seriously hurt their new practice. They had to make a living and build clientele. Epperly would suck up all of their time. Lookabill tried to plead with the judge the impact the case would have on his small firm. The judge merely replied, "Duly noted," and that was it. Stephen Epperly had representation. But would he get bail? Shockley argued strongly against it. But the judge set it at $25,000 cash or a $50,000 property bond. There was no way Stephen's family could raise that money. Warburton later recalled to author Ron Peterson that once he and Lookabill got over the money issue, they felt energized and challenged, and also proud that the judge had chosen them. They intended to work hard for their client, no matter their distaste for him and his crimes. They were professionals, and throughout the ordeal of Epperly's trial, conducted themselves as such. And they had quite the match in Shockley. He immediately moved to block almost all routine discovery motions, and the judge usually ruled in his favor. The one time he didn't, Shockley filed a writ of prohibition to the Supreme Court of Virginia. The court ruled in his favor, nullifying the judge's order, which had been to release copies of any witness statements, documents, photographs, and the polygraph examination results. That's a risky move on the part of any attorney. You don't want to alienate your judge before the trial even starts. But the stately judge overseeing Epperly's trial took it in stride and did not appear to hold it against Shockley. Lookabill and Warburton also asked the judge to reduce Epperly's bond so they could better consult with their client. They were refused. More importantly, they were shut down on a change of venue. This was a strenuous argument made by Lookabill and Warburton, and actually, I believe, a fair one. A change of venue is not at all unusual in a case with this much publicity. And the publicity was not just about the details of the Gina Renee Hall case. The papers had gotten a hold of police reports from the prior rape charges. The News Leader newspaper out of Staunton, Virginia, ran a story titled, "Man Charged with the Murder of Missing Radford Coed." The article leads out with the sentence, quote, "A man twice charged with rape has been charged with the murder of missing Radford University coed Gina Renee Hall." Naturally, the Associated Press and all other local papers grabbed this story as well. Now, everyone in Radford knew about the rumors surrounding Stephen Epperly that had persisted for years, but few knew he had actually been charged and gone to trial. Regardless of his acquittals, now everyone knew the man suspected of the violent murder of an 18-year-old college student had twice been charged with violent sexual assaults. But instead of a change of venue, the judge ordered a larger-than-normal jury pool. As this process was ongoing, Stephen Epperly's family had their home reappraised. They made payments with the help of friends and finally got the home equity back to $50,000. It was 1 month before trial, and Epperly got out on bond. But Shockley wasn't going to stand down on bail. He challenged Epperly's bond at another pretrial hearing. He had investigated and found another lien on the Epperly property that reduced their equity below the $50,000 required. I'm not gonna lie, Shockley was playing dirty, and I love it. He was well within his rights, but Epperly's attorneys were shocked. Losing the discovery motions was disheartening enough. But they worked with Stephen's family and knew how hard it had been to raise the money. Finally, one of Cubid's family members, who is a Presbyterian minister, put up his house to get Stephen Epperly out on bond. His attorneys were relieved. They were spending up to 3 hours daily to go see Epperly in the Pulaski jail, an hour and a half from their offices. It was a great burden, and they did need to work with their client. Jury selection began with a pool of 100. Only 59 people showed up. Two were immediately excused for health reasons. Due to the pre-trial publicity, the judge agreed that the question, "Do you believe Gina Hall is dead?" was enough to strike a juror for cause. That eliminated the pool by 10. The rest of the voir dire questions were routine. Do you know Stephen Epperly or his family? Do you know the Hall family? Are you related to the defendant or victim? And so on. After two more days, a panel of 24 jurors had been approved, 12 seated and 12 alternates. The judge felt this was more than fair, though he must have realized that by denying a change in venue, he was leaving a point open for appeal. Regardless, the trial of the Commonwealth versus Stephen M. Epperly began on December 9, 1980. Opening arguments began with Shockley leading strong. Lookabill spoke for Epperly. Shockley began his evidentiary portion of the trial oddly. Typically, prosecutors open with a witness who can place the victim with the accused. But Everett Shockley knew that his greatest obstacle of the trial was that first and foremost, he must prove that Gina Renee Hall was dead. So he first called Delana Hall, who was an extremely credible witness. She was not just close to her sister, she lived with her, knew her habits. She could speak to her character, and she could heartbreakingly explain just why Gina did not go off with boys. Due to her disfigurement from her burn scars, her sister did not date. She would never go to a cabin to swim with a group of strangers, a date, or even close friends. She was also able to positively identify all of Gina's clothing and her ankle bracelet as what she had seen her sister wearing the night she disappeared. In all, Shockley called 6 character witnesses, including Gina's father and her family doctor, to speak to her character and emotional stability. She wasn't some runaway teenager. She didn't do drugs. She barely drank. She was responsible, a good student, and hard worker who adored her family. She would never have been gone for what was now 5 months without a word to her family. And her bank account had not been touched since the night she went missing. Warburton delicately questioned these witnesses. It would do them no good to appear hostile to the grieving family. Next up was none other than Stephen Epperly's former best friend, Bill King. It was his family's cabin that Stephen took Gina to that night. He was able to testify to seeing Stephen and Gina at the bar that night, but firmly denied seeing Gina at the cabin. And even more damning, Bill testified to Epperly's asking him to tell his gym friends not to say he had been with Gina. The courtroom practically gasped at this revelation. Warburton conducted the cross-examination trying to discredit Bill King, but he proved to be an unflappable witness. Warburton scored a few minor points, but the damage was done. Other witnesses included the police captain who had spoken to Epperly on the RU campus that day and asked him to take a polygraph. In a pretrial hearing, that was one motion the defense had won. Though polygraphs are not admissible in court today, in 1980, the law was still shaky. Epperly's attorneys were ready for this and wanted to be sure it would not go on record. But in his cross-examination, Warburton was able to get the seasoned police captain to say that he had asked Epperly to take a polygraph. At this, Lookabill asked for a recess and then made a motion for mistrial, because the witness had used the term polygraph in reference to Stephen Epperly, even though he did not say whether or not Epperly had passed. His motion was denied. The rest of the prosecution's part of the trial was entering all of the physical evidence and questioning witnesses who could tie Stephen Epperly to the evidence. Gina's clothes had been entered with her sister. Now all the missing items from the cabin were identified and gone over. And one star witness of the trial was dog trainer John Preston. It wasn't just great evidence. The state again had a damning statement from Epperly when he exclaimed, "That's a damn good dog," in their presence. This was probably the witness that Warburton went the hardest at, and rightfully so. Let me explain. Harass, too, was a German shepherd. Typically, bloodhounds were used as tracking dogs, and their handlers accredited in courtrooms. On the 6th day of trial, at the lunch break, the defense attorneys and Stephen Epperly were walking to their office to eat lunch when 2 black men approached them wearing long overcoats. They were staring at Stephen Epperly. Lookabill noticed bulges in their coats, and realized they were carrying sawed-off shotguns. Right at the same moment, a reporter from a local news station burst around the corner to ambush Epperly and his attorneys. While the press had long been a distraction and obstacle in Epperly's trial, this reporter probably saved their lives. The two men ran off, obviously scared of the cameras and news crew, and the attorneys and Epperly ran for their office. Lookabill called 911, but the two men were in the wind. The gunmen have never been identified to this day. As the shaken attorneys returned to court that day, they had to face their most formidable witness, Trooper Austin Hall. He calmly and clearly took the jury through all of the evidence in the case, beginning with finding Gina's car, all the way to the end of the investigation. He was another unflappable witness, though Warburton did his best on cross. The worst Warburton could do was challenge his professional experience as a homicide investigator, as well as his memory. And this argument was weak. Trooper Hall was an outstanding witness. And Stephen Epperly knew it. He had seen the jurors' faces. He requested a meeting with the judge and presented a letter demanding that Lookabill and Warburton be relieved as his attorneys and a mistrial declared. The judge, who had handpicked these talented lawyers, wholeheartedly disagreed, calling their representation energetic and effective. Lookabill and Warburton didn't even really take it personally. They were losing this case, but not for lack of trying. Their client was guilty as hell. On the last day of trial, one of the prosecution's final witnesses was a forensic expert, there to testify to all the blood evidence. Again, this was pre-DNA, but considering all of the damning circumstantial evidence and the fact that the defendant admitted Gina had been to the lake house, the blood evidence was extremely strong. And though hair and fiber evidence is heavily scrutinized in modern trials, it was effective in Epperly's. Again, all the circumstantial evidence pointed to no other reasoning. And now they had a seasoned professional who had worked thousands of cases saying hairs and fibers were similar. The forensic specialist had to be careful to say similar and not a match, though, even in 1980. But hair similar to Gina's was found in the trunk of the car, on the towels found identified to belong to the cabin owners, and in different spots in the cabin where blood evidence was found. And on Gina's clothing, a head hair similar to that of Stephen Epperly was found. It was powerful testimony, but not as powerful as the next man to saunter into the courtroom. Everett Shockley said, "The defense calls William Cranwell, and everyone in the courtroom craned their necks to get a look." Bill Cranwell was well known as a Virginia Tech quarterback and a successful businessman throughout Virginia. He was also the man that Epperly and his shady buddy Tom Hardy had gone to for help, hoping his brother would defend Steve Epperly. Cranwell had shot them down quickly, and yet Epperly still had made a damning statement in his presence. Lookabill talked to author Ron Peterson about this moment. He and Warburton were blindsided. Though they had pleaded with Stephen Epperly to tell them anything he had done that could damage the case, Epperly had left this out. They did not see Cranwell coming, and they later lamented this to author Ron Peterson and in Woody Lookabill's own book, That's a Damn Good Dog. When Shockley asked, "Did Mr. Epperly ask you to ask anything of your brother?" Cranwell said, "He asked me, when you see your brother, ask him if there's anything they can do to me if they don't find her body." Decades later, Everett Shockley told Ron Peterson, "It was as if the air had been sucked out of the room." The very worst thing about this case was never finding Gina's body. Not just from a legal standpoint, but from a human standpoint. The New River Valley and the entire state was invested in bringing that girl home for a proper burial. If there had ever been any doubt that Stephen Epperly was responsible for Gina Hall's murder, it all dissolved in this moment. The bastard knew how hard it was to try a case without a body. He had talked to one of his own previous attorneys about it. But he had made this statement in front of the wrong man. Bill Cranwell was John Hall's roommate at Virginia Tech, and he turned on Stephen Epperly literally the moment he left his house. After Cranwell's testimony, Shockley rested his case for the Commonwealth. Lookabill immediately made a motion to strike and dismiss, arguing the state had not proven beyond a reasonable doubt that Gina Hall was dead and therefore had not met their burden of proof. The judge overruled the motion. And now it was the defense's turn to present evidence. Stephen Epperly did not take the stand, and his attorneys also rested, calling no witnesses of their own. Many lay people found this odd, but once again, I must thank Ron Peterson Jr. for explaining this so easily in his book, Under the Trestle. Epperly's attorneys had already submitted a motion to strike, effectively reasoning that the state had not met its burden of proof. By not putting on any witnesses, it shows the attorneys truly believed that there was insufficient evidence to convict their client, and putting on witnesses to refute any testimony would undercut that argument. Also, if they put on defense witnesses, justices on appeal would also be able to evaluate those witnesses along with all other evidence. And this was not without merit. I told you, the judge's refusal of a change of venue was problematic and could be reversible on appeal. Also problematic was the mention of the polygraph. And now it's time for closing arguments. Here, the prosecution always has the advantage. They get the first and last word. They are allowed to argue a rebuttal after the defense's closing argument. Making matters worse, Stephen Epperly chose to kneecap his own attorneys. Lookabill had opened the trial, and he had intended to close it. Warburton had been the attorney who cross-examined witnesses. There is an important reason for these two roles. If Warburton came off as too aggressive with sympathetic witnesses, the jury may come to dislike him. You don't want him making the closing argument. He was the point man, there to refute testimony, not eloquently argue in a closing statement. On the morning of final arguments, Stephen Epperly announced that he wanted Warburton to do the closing argument. Lookabill was exhausted, and Warburton was horrified. But as Lookabill said in his own book, Stephen Epperly was the boss. This was his trial, and if he wanted Warburton to close it, so be it. Warburton used the lunch hour to scratch out a hasty closing argument on a legal pad. I don't know how much you know about a closing argument, but attorneys literally prepare for them from the moment the trial begins, taking down notes to remember, buzzwords and phrases that they could tell resonated with the jury. It's not something they sit down and do the night before. And as David Warburton rose to address the jury, he quickly knew he could not read from his hastily written notes. He had to speak from memory and keep eye contact with the jury. He did the best he could under the circumstances, but in my opinion, this was an idiotic move on Stephen Epperly's part. It is just the sort of narcissistic, do-as-I-say attitude he was known for. After Shockley's rebuttal, the jury retired to deliberate. 2 hours later, the bailiff informed the judge that the jury had a verdict. They found Stephen Epperly guilty of first-degree murder and fixed his punishment as life in prison. After the verdict, the attorneys for Epperly argued for their client to remain out on bail as they planned to file an immediate appeal. This isn't unusual, especially in a case where attorneys feel confident they have scored points for an appeal. It is an advantage for their client to remain free so they can continue to work together. As the judge retired to his chambers, Epperly sought Shockley in the hallway and pleaded with him. He said he knew the state believed he was guilty and that he was probably going to prison, but he wanted to spend one last Christmas with his family. Shockley shrugged him off angrily. Epperly made the same appeal to the judge in his statement before sentencing, including the part about spending Christmas with his family. His attorneys pointed to his cooperation with law enforcement at all points in the investigation, saying he was not a flight risk. Shockley vehemently argued against this, stating that the only reason Epperly had always been so cooperative is because he believed that he could never be convicted without Gina's body. And then he made one last statement to the court. Quote, "And as far as Christmas, I can only say that Gina Hall is not going to be home with her parents for Christmas. Why should Stephen Epperly?" It was like the final nail in the coffin. In sentencing, the judge even mentioned Epperly's two prior rape trials as he handed down a life sentence. But per Virginia law, he would be eligible for parole in 15 years. An asshole down to the last moment, Epperly asked the judge to dismiss his counsel and appoint attorneys with actual criminal experience. It didn't matter that Lookabill and Warburton had fought for him every step of the way. Epperly was not thankful for them at all. The judge had anticipated this nonsense and was ready for Epperly, appointing two experienced appellate attorneys to the case. Lookabill told author Ron Peterson that when the case was finally over and they were no longer Epperly's attorneys, they got the final slap in the face in the mail. It was a check from the state of Virginia for $400. That was all they received for putting their practice on hold for months to defend that piece of shit, Stephen Epperly. As I said, Epperly did have some points for appeal, mainly that the state could not prove Gina Hall was dead, a mistrial should have been declared when the word polygraph was uttered, and finally, that the court erred in not granting a change of venue. There were other points in his first appeal and those following, but the state Supreme Court upheld the conviction, and it was upheld in every appeal following that. Stephen Epperly has now exhausted all avenues of appeal. But he did come up for parole in 1994, spurring Gina's family and their community to begin a letter-writing campaign to the parole board. They did this every 3 years, as Epperly would again be eligible to apply for parole. He has been denied every time, and the fact that he has never disclosed the whereabouts of Gina's body has hurt his chances to ever get out. Every time he comes up for parole, that is the argument against it. A prisoner must show remorse and change of character, and that son of a bitch will go to his grave never telling where he hid Gina Hall's body. It's incredibly ironic that the thing Stephen Epperly thought would keep him from being convicted is the very thing that keeps him from getting parole. He hid Gina's body so well, he thought he would never be prosecuted. And if he was, he would never be convicted. Well, he was wrong. And prison was not kind to the young Mr. Epperly. At 28 years old, buff from his workout regimen, blonde and good-looking, he was a target in prison for sexual predators. But not only that, there is a code even among murderers. Gina Hall's case got a lot of attention, and even hardened criminals hated Epperly for never telling where he hid her body. He was moved many times over the years to different correctional institutions, as his life was often in danger. There is really no telling how many times he was sexually assaulted in prison either. I do not condone rape in prison, nor do I find it funny by way of karma. I do believe even the worst of American criminals deserve protection in prison. But you cannot escape the irony of a sexual predator becoming a target in prison. It's usually reserved for pedophiles, but the young and handsome Stephen Epperly was different. He last came up for parole in 2018. He was again denied. He was 66 years old. And he still refused to tell what he did with Gina's body. I told you before that Delana has always been stuck on one detail that she felt proved her sister did not go willingly. While she conceded that she could have been tricked, she never believed it. The point she was stuck on was that the driver's side handle of Gina's car door was broken. Delana shared this car with her sister and knew it was not broken before that night. Whether or not we choose to believe the internet commenter who came forward so many years later about Gina walking herself out that night, Delana is not at all wrong about this point. I think Stephen Epperly was rebuffed by Gina Hall after they danced a few times. Beautiful, effervescent, Gina Renee Hall really was just there to dance. And she was a beautiful dancer. She just wanted to enjoy herself and celebrate the end of exams. She was shy with men and never dated. A man like Stephen Epperly coming on so strong would not just have turned her off, but probably frightened her. And I think it's very possible he waited and then forced himself into her car. At the cabin, I think she begged to call her sister to let her know she was okay and hoping to raise the alarm. And Stephen let her make the call, maybe hoping to calm her down. We can't know what happened after that. All we know is that Gina died a violent and bloody death on the floor of that cabin. And as horrific as that is, her death was not in vain. Her case set legal precedent in the state of Virginia for no-body cases, also helping to set legal precedent all over the country. And further, after Epperly's trial, the Virginia legislature took a hard look at their laws governing sexual assault. Virginia passed sweeping legislation for sexual assault reform just a year after Epperly was convicted, including a rape shield law encouraging victims to come forward. Gina's father passed away in 2011 without ever seeing his daughter laid to rest. His family credits him with giving them the strength to get through the decades-long ordeal of Stephen Epperly's trial, appeals, and parole hearings, as well as the loss and grief of never recovering Gina's remains. And Virginia law enforcement and Gina's community has never given up trying to find her body and bring her home for the proper Christian burial her family so wanted and deserved. A new Radford police lieutenant named Andy Wilburn petitioned to reopen Gina's case about 10 years ago. To this day, her case is open and Wilburn is actively looking for her. And there are many theories on where Gina could be, too many to name here. But I will say, Gina's case has been featured on a few ghost hunter shows because people believe her spirit haunts the old St. Albans Sanitarium. It was located just down the hill from the trestle where Gina's car was found, and portions of the building were under construction in the summer of 1980. Many people, not just ghost hunters, believe Stephen Epperly hid her body there. Whether or not you believe in ghosts, these shows inspire a new generation of young people who want to find Gina Renee Hall and finally bring her home. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Thank you to Jessica Irvin for suggesting Gina's case. I highly recommend the book Under the Trestle, The 1980 Disappearance of Gina Renee Hall and Virginia's First No-Body Murder Trial by Ron Peterson Jr. It came out in 2018, so his research was over three decades after Gina's murder. He gained the trust of her family, law enforcement, and the defense attorneys, though not from Stephen Epperly. Gina's sister has also written a book, not just with her own theories of the case, but her spiritual transformation of overcoming her trauma after her sister's murder. It's called Miraculous Journey, A Day Made in Heaven, and is available on Amazon, along with Mr. Peterson's book and Epperly's defense attorney, Woody Lookabill's book, That's a Damn Good Dog. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com. There you can sign up to be a patron of the show, make a one-time donation, or purchase show merchandise. That's southernfriedtruecrime.com. And don't forget to check out my YouTube channel. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. Private messages on social media get lost, so email is best. And please feel free to reach out. I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.